Hello, microbe friends. I'm Dr. Justine Dees, and welcome to the Joyful Microbe Podcast. It's the show all about the microbes we encounter in our daily lives. Thank you so much for tuning in. I can't wait to share this show with you. If you're able to right now, go outside and look around. I bet within a few steps, you could spot the subject of this podcast episode. Lichens. They are those colorful growths on trees and rocks and even mailboxes and fences. Have you ever noticed them? Lichens are all around us, yet they're often overlooked. Maybe you are aware of them. That's awesome. But do you know what they do in ecosystems? Many people don't fully understand these symbiotic organisms or appreciate their significance. If you listened to my previous episode with Dr. Clara Sharnagle, you got an introduction to lichens. But there's so much more to know about these amazing creatures. That's why today I'll be chatting with Dr. Jessica Allen, a lichenologist from Eastern Washington University. We discuss what lichens are, how they are miniature ecosystems harboring diverse microorganisms, all about their many important roles in the world, how they can live on a wide range of surfaces, and when they're living on some strange object like a couch in a swamp or a discarded cowboy boot on a mountain biking trail, how do they obtain the nutrients that they need? We also talk about how scientists use lichens to monitor air quality, how long they live, how they have historically been used in making dyes and fragrances, and Jessica also shares a couple of lichen myths. Lastly, she gives us three at-home microbiology activities to explore and appreciate lichen diversity. After listening to this episode, you'll come away seeing lichens in a whole new light. All right, let's get on to the interview. Hi, Jesse. Thanks so much for coming on the Joyful Microbe Podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm always excited to chat about microbes and especially lichens.
Well, lichens are one of my absolute favorite members of the microbial world because we get to enjoy them on a daily basis since they're just about everywhere when you step outside. Funny enough, I've even seen them inside someone's house who had used repurposed bricks that had lichens on them to build their fireplace. I doubt it was intentional to include the lichens, but they were there nonetheless.
Oh, what a fabulous touch. Yeah. I 100% approve of that decorating move right there.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So I'm very excited to chat with you today about lichens and hear your perspective on these intriguing composite organisms. But first, how did you get interested in microbes and lichens, and what was your path to becoming a lichenologist?
Yeah, so I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I always loved being outside and really doing anything outside, and I was down for it. But when I went to college, I went to university to study music. I played the saxophone. And then I was introduced to conservation biology and a really different take on science than I had been introduced to in high school. This more sort of curiosity-driven work and applied science and just kind of opened up this whole new world for me within the natural world that I already enjoyed so much. And reading like Silent Spring by Rachel Carson was particularly formative for me. And so I switched to biology. And in my first year as an undergraduate student biology major, we went through every single chapter in the book diligently in the intro bio book, but my professor skipped the chapter on fungi. So I had to go back and read it. I was like, what are these seemingly unimportant organisms, and I read it and I was like, oh no, this is the cool stuff. And luckily I went to a university with a fabulous mycologist on the faculty, and Suzanne Schwab, and the next term she was teaching mycology, and so I got to take a whole quarter-long class in mycology, including like collecting mushrooms and culturing fungi and all sorts of awesome stuff. And so I went on to take pretty much every class that she offered. And I also worked with another professor here studying kind of plant evolution and speciation. So I kind of got introduced to fungi and to thinking about evolution in a really kind of at that like species population level, and kind of generally had a great education here. But through looking at all of these different groups of fungi, the lichens just captured my heart because I thought they were the most beautiful. There was that factor of just seeing them everywhere all the time, and you know, having grown up with them all around me and noticing them, and certainly having brought some inside for decor when I was a kid. That kind of revelation of what they actually were was pretty spectacular. So it's kind of like this secret hiding in plain sight. Yeah. And then I was hooked, and I've just, you know, been really lucky to have some fabulous opportunities to continue studying lichens, you know, as an intern at the Field Museum, at New York Botanical Garden, during graduate school, as a postdoc, and then now as a professor at Eastern Washington University, I get to, you know, run a whole research lab about lichens.
Wow. That is so cool. I love that you studied music to begin with and that you switched over from that. I relate to that in some ways because I sang a lot growing up and then kind of considered that as a career, but ended up like had this like dual passion, you know, like singing and then also biology. So, I think it's, you know, I relate to that a lot, but also how funny that your teacher skipped the chapter on fungi. And I think it's awesome that you were just like, well, I want to figure out what this is. And you read the chapter and then that's what you ended up pursuing. What a neat story.
Yeah. You know, I think fungi sometimes get overlooked and underestimated and underappreciated, but man, they're some of the coolest organisms out there and they're so important. I think, you know, they're getting a lot more attention these days than even just a few years ago. And that is awesome. I feel like they're kind of, maybe I'm in a bubble, but I really feel like they're having a moment right now. And
I think so.
People are gaining a lot more appreciation and wonder and understanding at kind of the whole fungal world out there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's more books coming out on them that are like popular science books and documentaries that are helping spread the word a little bit about how cool they are. And of course that lichens captured your heart. I wish that lichens had been covered in, you know, when I learned about fungi, but they weren't. So I figured that out later, but they did capture my heart, especially once I realized what they were. It's like, what? They're like, you know, two or more organisms. Like, it's so cool. And they're beautiful, of course, like you said. And it's like once you start seeing them, you see them everywhere. You know, I think I feel like as a kid, you learn about them, but I don't think I really knew what they I don't think I really grasped what they were when I was little. Because it's like I vaguely remember it being something that I had learned what it was, but so what they are, that was a good question. Because I feel like we should cover that very basic question of what are lichens exactly.
And it seems like such a simple question, but I feel like it gets more complex every day that we make a new discovery. But I'll start with like kind of our most basic sort of textbook answer. One that, like you may have heard as a kid. I assume that I also heard it at some point, but it didn't make necessarily make sense to me or something. Mm-hmm. It didn't stick until I was older. And that would just be that they're a symbiotic organism, or like you said, a composite organism. They're composed of a fungus, mostly. Most of a lichen is made up of a fungus. And then the other partner in this symbiotic relationship is an alga. And that could be a green alga or a cyanobacterium, or sometimes both. So you have what's called a tripartite symbiosis, where there's a fungus, a green alga, and a cyanobacterium. And so the essentially, like I said, most of that structure that you see is made from the fungus, and then the algae live inside of that structure. They're not inside of the cells of the fungus, but they're inside of that overall structure, where they're a little bit protected from things like ultraviolet light, and they're kept a bit moister inside of the lichen. But they still usually are sort of near the surface, where they can get plenty of light for photosynthesis, right? So they're using that power from the sun and capturing carbon dioxide and making sugars. And of course, the algae use those sugars to grow themselves, but then they also shuttle a lot of those sugars to the fungus. So we sort of see this as like a what we would call a mutualistic symbiotic relationship, where there are clear benefits to both partners. But even that sort of basic relationship between that the fungus and the alga has been discussed at length. So some people have called it a controlled parasitism, because the fungus does release some compounds that control the growth rate of the alga and their reproduction and things like that. So there's this question of like, are the algae really benefiting? And some people have called them fungi that discovered agriculture. Like kind of more imagining that they're farming the algae because how they're controlling the growth rate. So there are still some questions about kind of how that interaction works out, and if you think about like the accounting of who's benefiting from this interaction. But fundamentally, both of those, you know, both something that's photosynthesizing, an alga and a fungus, have to be together for a lichen to exist. Now, we have expanded quite drastically our kind of perception of lichens in the past decade or so to encompass a lot of other organisms that are always or very frequently also found in lichens beyond that main single fungal partner and that single algal partner. We've really realized that there's actually this like incredibly diverse and abundant bacterial community. There are other fungi that are not the main lichen symbiont. There's usually like an entire community of microalgae in the lichen as well, in addition to some tardigrades and nematodes and other critters. But all of these microorganisms are really living together in the lichen, and there are so many things that we still don't quite understand about how all of those interactions kind of occur, and the kind of the nature of all of those interactions, and kind of trying to piece apart these many, many microbes that are growing together. So my favorite definition of a lichen now is that they're miniature ecosystems. And I feel like that encompasses better just the amount of diversity that is present in every single lichen that you see. And because of that, the diversity of interactions that are happening in there among all of those components.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, aren't we all, like, everything that's living is a miniature ecosystem? Because, like, with the human microbiome existing on and in us, and then even little mites that live on our bodies that we don't really think about. Yeah, it's very interesting to think about it that way. So, but it also gets me thinking about like the structure. Like you were saying that you've got the fungus and that provides like the structure of the, I guess, the ecosystem. And then that's like the body, so like the human body. And in a way, when you were talking about it, it almost made me think of like a house. Like we live inside of the house. We don't live in the walls, just like the algae lives like kind of within the fungus, but it doesn't necessarily – it doesn't live within its cell walls.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. Yeah. And I also love that you bring up, you know, essentially like we're all these miniature ecosystems and yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's, through studying lichens and their diverse, biomes, it has made me appreciate that even that fact even more about, right, like my own self, and every other organism out there. So, kind of through that lens of lichens, I feel like my own perception of what I, used to really think of as, you know, these individual organisms really separate are actually really connected and kind of these hubs of interactions in a way. And that's something I really appreciate about lichens because I think they're a great kind of way to shift that perspective. Yeah.
And I think even thinking about like tardigrades in lichens, I've noticed that just, you know, from the little bit of looking at tardigrades under the microscope, when, you know, when I learned about it, it was like, you can look at moss or you can look at lichens. And I've found that in some cases where I was trying to look at moss, then I just picked, you know, like I took a little tiny piece of the lichen and it was close to the moss on the tree. And then like the lichen had way more tardigrades. And I'm not saying that's a rule, but it was just interesting that it seemed like it was a great home for them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I have found tardigrades on both lichens and mosses, and I think I don't know if somebody has figured out a rhyme or reason to that, but I do love you bring that up because I think, you know, lichens and mosses and, you know, other bryophytes are really kind of, they're found together a lot. They're similar sizes, and it's a great point to bring up because lichens and mosses are different things, but they do get confused a lot. And actually, our main professional society in North America is the American Bryological and Lichenological Society. So even lichenologists and bryologists hang out together quite a bit. And this is, it's kind of a, it's also kind of fun because there's a little bit of a historical legacy there because, it took people a while to figure out what lichens were. And the idea of them being these composite organisms was first proposed by Simon Schwendener in the 1800s. But it wasn't really widely accepted until about the mid 1900s. Right. So that's not actually that long ago. And, that through that kind of intervening time, people kind of just lumped them in with plants. And so we still, you know, because of that long-term confusion about what the heck is a lichen, we still do spend a lot of time hanging out with plant people, which I really enjoy. So.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. So also thinking more about like the idea of them being mini ecosystems. How, I guess I'm like thinking about like the scientists use the word biogeography, like the, what it actually looks like. If you could zoom in and look at like, is the fungus like the big structure, like you said, and then you've got like the alga in there, but then you've got all these other organisms. Like, what would that look like if we walked through the house and looked around? And would there just be like a few cells of bacteria of a certain type here and there? Or I'm just kind of curious, like, has anyone really figured that out?
Yeah, so we do have some really good clues about that lichen microcosm. And yes, if I really wish I could shrink down and walk through one day. But at least imagining it is pretty great, right? So yeah, so there would be the fungal cells, which are strings of cells. They would look like kind of see-through spaghetti noodles in a lot of ways. And the algae, those cells are much larger. They're round and they're green. So I like to think of those as like the kind of grassy meatballs of the lichen spaghetti. And then the tardigrades would be much bigger than they are bigger than the algae and the nematodes as well. And then, of course, the bacteria are smaller. So if there are cyanobacteria, they're much smaller. And then the other bacteria are as well. And they would be, found certainly some inside the lichen. And then a lot of the kind of, what would you say, like that microbial action also happens in the outermost layers of the lichens. So if you ever like cut into a lichen and look at it, even under just a lower power microscope, if you take one that's leafy, you'll see that it has layers. And so there's this kind of top layer and bottom layer where the cells are really dense. There are a lot of sugars in there. And it seems like there are quite a few bacteria and fungi that really like to live on those kind of outer layers as well as inside of the lichen. So what's interesting as far as like the relative abundance, what we do know is that the bacterial communities are very abundant and that is based abundant and really diverse. And that's based on some studies where people, they grind up a whole lichen and then they sequence a small piece of DNA from all the different kind of critters that are in there. And so they can tell what all is there and how abundant they are in relation to each other. And based on some of those studies, like 75% of the sequences that come back come from bacteria, from all over kind of different, many, many different lineages of bacteria. So we know that they're abundant, we know that they're diverse, and we're still trying to kind of figure out more about what's going on there kind of functionally, and if there are lineages or like certain groups of bacteria that are found in a lot of different lichens. There's some really interesting studies recently looking at what they call the core microbiome. So like bacteria that are found in many individuals of the same species across whole landscapes and abundantly as well, to see like, okay, are there some bacteria that like come and go, maybe they're coming in from the environment, and then some bacteria that are like really core to this symbiotic organism and we just have overlooked it in the past. And it looks like there are some groups that are coming up over and over again, and that we're kind of starting to sort through who might be some of those key players. And yeah, so that's been a pretty exciting development in our understanding of the bacterial communities, for sure.
That's so fascinating to think about. I hadn't considered the idea of lichens having, I thought about the tardigrades, but hadn't considered the rest of the ecosystem. So that's pretty amazing. I love picturing that. And so thanks for describing that. Mm-hmm. So we know they're beautiful and we can see them everywhere, but I feel like the fact that they're everywhere means that they're important, but I don't think that we all appreciate their importance in the world. So what's the significance of lichens in our ecosystems and what vital roles do they play? Like, why should we pay attention to them beyond their aesthetic appeal?
Yeah, great question. Like you said, they are everywhere. And like all other groups of organisms, they're integral to kind of the natural world functioning, our world functioning. And there are many different ways that they kind of plug in to ecosystems. So a lot of lichens are food for animals, both large and small. So everything from like pikas and rabbits and flying squirrels, you know, all the way up to mountain goats and moose, moose especially often use it as a winter forage along with deer. But then the most famous lichen eaters are the caribou or the reindeer. And lichens are a huge component of their diet. So, and this really applies to all groups of caribou. So there are caribou that are that we see in the tundra, you know, where there are no trees, and there are caribou, different groups of caribou that live in the boreal forest. But all of them eat lichens, and abundantly so, and at all times of the year. So they're really completely reliant on lichens as the main part of their diet. And there's been, you know, with kind of logging in the boreal forest, there's been some decline in lichen communities, you know, forest extent for sure, and lichen communities. And that's part of the reason that that's one of the reasons that we're seeing declines in caribou populations throughout North America. So that's one of way that they're really important in these ecosystems. And then animals also use them as nesting material. So again, the squirrels, but birds use them for nesting material quite a bit, especially hummingbirds. And then insects also use them as food and camouflage, and other invertebrates do as well. So like snails and slugs eat lichens a lot. And you can actually see like where they've gone across eating a lichen, because they have these sort of what we'd call rasping mouth parts. So it's like looks like a rake kind of went across the lichen. That's kind of a fun thing to look for if you start looking at lichens.
Oh, I'm going to have to look for that.
Yeah, for sure. And then one of my favorite lichen invertebrate interactions involves lace wings. So lace wing larvae coat themselves in lichens, and especially prefer a particular lichen called the fairy dust lichen. This is the genus Lepraria. So they make like a whole shell on their back. And I usually get surprised by these because I'm trying to look at lichens or collect lichens and then they start moving. Anyway, I'm like, oh, right, it's a lacewing larva. And it's fantastic because these lichens are, you know, they have all this like massive antibacterial properties. And this particular one is really like water repellent. So I always think of it as their kind of self-made camouflage raincoats. And then when they go to metamorphose, they completely encapsulate themselves in these fairy dust lichens, make these perfect little capsules, you know, metamorphose, turn into the phase of their life cycle where they have wings. And once they're done with that, they cut this perfect little cap off of that capsule, this like little hole, pop off the top, and out they go. So this really lovely interaction there. But there are tons of insects that have evolved to use lichens as camouflage, essentially. So they blend in perfectly with lichens. And then when we think a bit more about kind of ecosystem, like whole systems level importance, lichens are really substantial nitrogen, bioavailable nitrogen sources in forest ecosystems, especially the lichens that associate with cyanobacteria, because cyanobacteria can take nitrogen from the atmosphere and transform it into a form that other organisms can use for nutrients. They're in more arid regions, they're really important for soil stabilization. So they're kind of a key component of biological soil crusts, which are a great topic to come up in a microbe podcast for sure. So these are, you know, communities of free living cyanobacteria and mosses and lichens that live in usually arid ecosystems and form these kind of crusts across the top of the soil. So they're really important when we think about soil erosion and like massive dust storms and things like that. Having those soil crusts intact is essential. And then what I always come back to is that when I think about the importance of lichens, that the fact that each one of them is home to so many other organisms. So much smaller organisms, and that, you know, like I've mentioned before, we don't even know what all is going on there, but they're supporting, each lichen is really supporting a lot of diversity, both at the microscopic and the macroscopic scale. So sometimes I really think of lichens as being one of these organisms that rests like directly at the fulcrum of the macroscopic and the microscopic in this kind of really exquisite way.
Oh man. Yeah. That's really cool. They do so many things. And thinking about them as supporting all these different larger organisms like goats and reindeer, and then smaller organisms like insects, and then even to very small organisms that are living on them. So that's really cool to think about how much they do, and we overlook them. And the idea that the lace wings use them as camouflage, that's super cool. And it kind of brings me to another question, that lichens make their homes on lots of different surfaces or substrates, like obviously now we know lace wings and things like rocks and trees, and I've seen them on mailboxes. And even when I was mountain biking one time, I saw one on an old cowboy boot and I was like, oh, how pretty. So what makes a good substrate for a lichen, and what are some of the, we've named, you know, the lace wings, but what are some of the strangest substrates they can live on?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the, like, the key ingredients for a good substrate are really stability, lack of disturbance, and an area where the air quality is not super poor. And then often you'll see bigger lichens or showier lichens in places where it's perhaps a bit more humid or rainy, and there's still plenty of light. Now, lichens some lichens can grow on all sorts of stuff, including cowboy boots, but other other lichens are really particular, right? They're like, there's like, they'll only grow on a particular plant species, like a bark of a particular species when it's really old, and only on like the dry side, right around the, like close to the base or something. Like, so some of them are so picky, but then of course others are not. And those are the ones that you can capture on the cowboy boot, or things like, I've seen them on, you know, tin cans discarded out around. You can see them growing on traffic signs sometimes. I've seen them on like discarded cars that were rusting. But my favorite atypical lichen substrate was a couch that had been dumped into a swamp. And I was out on a collecting trip with some other lichenologists. And we ended up collecting so many different species from this couch. It was wild. It was like this lichen bonanza on this couch in the swamp. And it was 100% covered in lichens. So they really just loved it. So lots of, you know, lots of human-made substrates can be colonized by lichens in the right conditions.
So I wonder, like, if they're just hanging on to the metal of a sign or the plastic of a mailbox or the fabric of a couch. I mean, are they using anything on the substrate for their nutrition, or is it more just this is somewhere I'm hanging on to and then I'm getting the rest that I need from other places? Like through, I don't know, stuff being carried in the wind.
Yeah.
Because they're not moving around. So I'm just curious, like, how does that work?
Yeah, great question. And this is one that I think people are still trying to really fully parse out. But, you know, of course, we know that the main source of sugar comes from the algae, right? So they're getting one part of their nutrition. And of course, sorry, I'm very fungal biased. I just have to say that I think that was just coming through right there pretty clearly. Obviously, the algae are photosynthesizing. Okay, but if we think about the thallus, like the lichen body, which we call the thallus, as a whole, certainly there are some nutrients that are drifting in on the wind or coming in with rain. Absolutely, you know, atmospheric deposition is a huge part of kind of how lichens interact with the world, both in acquiring nutrients and then, you know, when we have a chance to talk about air pollution, that will come up again. And then the way that they attach to their substrate or whatever they're growing on can depend a bit. So some of the sugars they make are very in a way kind of glue them to things. So that's more of an exterior attachment. However, those fungal cells, those.
Hey there, it's me, Justine, founder of Joyful Microbe. Guess what? I'm not just passionate about spreading microbiology joy through my podcast. I'm also interested in helping others create engaging scientific content. As a freelance science writer and editor with a PhD in microbiology, I bring a blend of scientific expertise and effective communication. No need to hire two people to get the job done. I've got it all covered. If you love what I've created on Joyful Microbe, imagine what we can do together for your project. Whether you're a life science company or an academic and need compelling content, I'm here to help. If you've got something in mind and want to chat about it, send me an email at justine@justinedees.com or check out my website, justinedees.com. Let's turn your ideas into awesome science content. Can't wait to collaborate with you. Now, back to the show.
The strings of cells are, you know, spaghetti noodles, if you will, can grow into what they are living on as well. Now, this has been a really interesting avenue of research because, and I'm trying to decide where to start. Well, on, it's hard to say how far they go in because we don't see evidence that lichens killed trees, for instance, right? So, you know, I've heard from people that, you know, they say, oh, there's so many lichens on my trees, so I scraped them off because I think they were killing them. That is not true. Do not kill the lichens. So even if they are kind of in the tissue a bit, they're not like a pathogen on a tree. But the interesting discoveries, I think, have been related to how far lichens that grow on rocks can be found growing into the rock. So certainly we have, like, it's very clear that lichens that grow on rocks, those fungal cells grow into the rocks, and they actually are part of breaking down rocks. So the lichens are secreting acids, and they're kind of expanding and contracting and kind of slowly breaking the rocks down. But there are lichens that don't even have any, like, real tissue on the outside of the rocks. They're growing completely inside of the rocks. They're what we call endolithic lichens. So, like, the algae and the fungi have just, like, wedged themselves between rock minerals, and, like, that is how they grow. And so these are fun to find because if you kind of pick away at the minerals of some rocks, you'll be surprised to find under that upper layer, you can see the algae. Now, the fungal partner can actually grow quite deep into rocks, is something that has been discovered more recently. And so that, I think, really brings up this discussion of, you know, how much nutrients are they getting from the rocks? What kind of nutrients are they getting from the rocks? And maybe it's a lot more than we had previously assumed.
Yeah. Okay. So that is really interesting to think about. And I guess what you said earlier about just how the fungus and the alga rely on each other is probably part, I mean, I'm assuming here, and I'd like to hear what you think, but it's probably contributes to how ubiquitous they are, is their relative autonomy, where they can just depend on each other and not necessarily have to rely on, you know, what comes from whatever substrate they're on. But it does sound like in some cases that they use stuff from the substrate.
So what are your thoughts? I think that's a great summary, right? And especially framing it that way, because then you can think about maybe in certain situations or at particular times, a lichen might draw more nutrients from their substrate than others, but they have that flexibility built in because of the nature of that symbiosis.
Yeah. So I guess you kind of touched on some of the environmental conditions that they thrive in, but is there anything else you'd like to mention about like what they need? And actually, I mean, that makes me think that it sounds like talking about lichens in general is difficult, probably, because some of them seem to be a little bit more sensitive, and then others are a lot, more hardy, and they can survive in lots of different conditions. So I'm sure this is a complex question, but is there anywhere that in general they can't survive or you wouldn't find them?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, if you were like, I want to go out and maximize my chance of finding so many fabulous lichens, there are some places where you would not find as many. And so most lichens are terrestrial, so they live in land-based ecosystems. There are some freshwater lichens that actually live in the water, but not very many and not very abundantly. And there are some lichens that are marine. They mostly live on kind of intertidal rocks, and they're super cool. And some of them like associate with a brown algae, which are a completely very, very far flung group of algae from the algae that most lichens associate with. But once you get into any deep water, you won't find any lichens. Especially like not in a marine system or freshwater system. And then the other place that I have found lichens to be less abundant are areas where mosses just like take over. So that would be like the temperate rain, some parts of the temperate rainforest. I've been in cloud forests where most of the epiphytes are mosses and other plants. And again, there are lichens there, but they're being outcompeted by these other groups of organisms. And so they're maybe just not quite as diverse and easy to see as in some other areas. And then the other place where sometimes it can be tricky to find lichens are in some cities. So some cities are actually like the lichens are so abundant and diverse, but in some cities they're not as abundant and diverse. It really just depends on kind of the history of that particular city, the history of air quality there, But in most cities worldwide, there still are lichens, even if you're not as likely to come across like the really fancy, showy ones that you might see in a more natural area.
Well, that's interesting. And you touched on air quality, and this is something I think is so interesting, but lichens have been called bioindicators, so they're like the canary in the coal mine. And so can you tell us a little bit more about what specific environmental factors they are used to monitor and why they're such reliable indicators?
Yeah, so lichens are really sensitive to sulfur-based air pollutants, and those tend to be really lethal for a lot of lichens. So, and the amount of like sulfur-containing pollutants that was being released was much higher kind of early on in the Industrial Revolution, all the way through about the 70s or so, and it's declined since then. And so what we really saw was that and just air quality in general, like the Clean Air Act has saved so many lives. Anyways, it's just amazing. We take our usually quite clean air sometimes for granted, I think, because back in the 50s and 60s, there were even smog events in New York City that were so severe that people like suffocated from them and died. Mm. So, and that again was not that long ago. And so, you know, those like air quality regulations have been super effective, and we can see that mirrored in the lichens, where in many cities in the United States and in other parts of the world, there was a massive decline in lichen diversity and abundance, and to the point of having some areas that were truly lichen deserts where there were no lichens. Wow. And since, you know, since there has been a global push to improve air quality, we've seen lichens moving back into cities and really coming back, and in some places really thriving, which is fabulous. So that's one part of the story. And then the other part is that while sulfur-based pollutants have declined, nitrogen deposition has increased. And so the high nitrogen environments are supportive of a certain subset of lichens, a subset of lichens that are not as diverse. And really, it seems that most lichens are what we call oligotrophs, which means that they don't prefer like high nutrient systems. So high nitrogen environments, they can't actually live there. So now we are more concerned about that from an air quality perspective. So kind of looking at sulfur and nitrogen. And then lichens do bioaccumulate things like heavy metals. They can bioaccumulate radionuclides. And so if you're looking at more localized pollutants, like in a X mining site or somewhere that there was some, you know, nuclear waste or you know, any sort of like release of nuclear material, you can see that in the lichens there will be elevated either heavy metals or nuclear materials. And so and that has to do with what you brought up earlier with, you know, things, whatever particles flying through the air and landing on lichens and then interacting with them. So they while they have kind of a thicker outer layer, it's not to the level of, for instance, if you think about a tree, right? So a tree has bark, which is a really thick, like a pretty thick, robust protective layer. And then the leaves have kind of a waxy coating that we call the cuticle. And then in many deciduous trees and, you know, even in evergreens, leaves are dropped periodically. So they're kind of a temporary material that can be dropped. But with lichens, it's like, it is what it is. Like what you see is what you get, and that's what's going to be there for a really long time in many cases. And so they're just absorbing everything from the air all the time. And sometimes that leads to a lot of damage for the lichens, or maybe they can hold that material and we can use that to understand things like heavy metal deposition. And certainly this, like these kind of like pretty intricate interactions between lichens and different pollutants have been used worldwide to develop air quality monitoring programs. So scientists can go to a particular place, document what all lichen species are there, how abundant any given species is, and get a kind of a sense of what particular air pollutants might be impacting that area, at what level they might be impacting the area, and they can get a pretty sensitive read on it. And this is a more economical way to monitor air quality than putting out as many air quality monitors as, you know, these devices. And it also means that you can get these, you know, the lichens are really reflecting these kind of long-term averages in deposition, and you can look at change over time, you know, by revisiting the same sites if you need to, or the same areas. And again, like the United States Forest Service does a ton of this work. Linda Geiser has been an incredible leader in that. You see this in other countries all over the world.
Well, that's very interesting that you can use them in that way. And that there's actually programs that will kind of collect that information and then give you a readout on the quality and what's going on in the area. I think that's so cool. And you said you can track it over time. So that kind of makes me think, like, how long do lichens typically live?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is another one where you say it depends. I guess I should have maybe earlier said there are 20,000 named species of lichens. The names apply to the fungus, and lichens have evolved at least, you know, at least like 8 or 10 times across the fungal tree of life. So they're also not all related to each other. Anyways, so it depends, like everything in biology. We have everything from lichens that grow on leaves, especially in tropical and subtropical areas, and they might have a 1 to 2 year lifespan, pretty quick. To the oldest lichens have been estimated to be over 5,000 years old. And those are lichens that are growing in Antarctica. So really there, which, because lichens are one of the most diverse groups of organisms on Antarctica by a long shot. And, you know, they spend quite a bit of their lives being inactive. And really in those like polar environments, they maybe grow a couple millimeters a year. But then they can hang on for a really long time. So, however, if we are thinking about, like, maybe you're in a temperate, more of a temperate zone, and interacting with lichens there, you know, you're probably looking at species that are living maybe like a couple to a few decades to up to maybe a few hundred years. There's been a really good kind of detailed study of the lifespan of Lobaria pulmonaria. This is the lungwort lichen in some parts of its range. And it does depend a lot on climate. So in really like oceanic climates, sort of like maybe the west coast of Scotland, it can grow pretty fast. And it can produce structures that make kind of sexual spores. So spores via sexual reproduction within, you know, maybe 5 years even. But in more continental climates, so climates that are a bit colder and less wet, it looks like it takes more like 30 years to reach sexual maturity. And then we're looking at a lifespan that's much longer. So varies by environment, varies by species. But there are a lot of lichens that are long-lived and somewhat slow-ish growing, with a lot of caveats.
Well, that gives us a good overview for sure of like what the ranges are. And earlier you mentioned lichens living in cities, and so that brings us to the fact that you wrote a book And I definitely want to touch on that. It's called Urban Lichens, a Field Guide for Northeastern North America. Focuses on lichens in cities like New York and Boston. So what was your motivation to specifically highlight lichens in cities? And are there, like, how do they differ from lichens in suburban or rural areas?
So I did my doctoral research at the New York Botanical Garden, and I ended up living in New York City for 6 years. And while I was there, I participated in bio blitzes with the Macaulay Honors College. So at the beginning of each school year, all of the sophomores in Macaulay Honors College would have to participate in an event at a city park somewhere in New York and go around with different taxonomic experts and look at kind of all the organisms living there. So I volunteered to help out with that. I'm not going to remember the first year off the top of my head, in Central Park. And I, you know, because of this kind of idea that, oh, lichens aren't really in cities that much, and there aren't very many of them, they're not as exciting, I was like, okay, well, this will be a fun outreach event, but we're not going to find anything interesting right in Central Park. There's no way. And then I spent 2 days traipsing all over that park with a bunch of students. It was so much fun. And we found so many lichens. And that was honestly the initiation of it. I was just blown away by that. And so from there, you know, leading various lichen walks throughout New York City, participating in more of the bio blitzes, every time that I gave a lichen walk or spiel in the city, like without fail, somebody was like, wow, this is so cool. Lichens are amazing. They're so beautiful. I had no idea. So now what do I do? Because I want to learn more. And there are some great lichen books out there and field guides, but there was nothing for the city specifically, and lichens in cities, they look a little different, right? They're like a little bit stressed. Sometimes the algae kind of like escape and grow over the top of the fungus.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes, like, yeah, all sorts of wild things can happen in the city. And those field guides where you take like the picture of the most beautiful pristine lichen is not necessarily, like, you could figure it out, but it might not be that easy to figure out what you're looking at. So that was kind of, that was really the origin of that. That book was just, you know, people just kept asking for it. So I thought, well, I guess I should just write it then. And it was really fun to write because, like, as I was writing that front, like the first part, that's kind of the overview of lichens with all of that information. I was just kind of replaying all of these interesting and fun conversations I've had with people over those years and just trying to basically like answer all of those questions that come up for people in a really short amount of space and make it really accessible. So the idea was essentially for anybody who lives in a city and they maybe see lichens around and want to take that next step, there's now a book for them.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really, really neat. And I love that, you know, they can look a little bit different. The idea of the algae escaping, that's kind of funny. Oh, I love that.
Morphs.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about something that I've kind of read about briefly, and it intrigued me a lot. And it was mentioned in the book Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake. He talks about how lichens are useful in many ways to humans because, and he says in the book, they produce more than 1,000 chemicals that are not found in any other life form. I find that fascinating. Can you talk about this a little bit, and what are some of the intriguing and practical applications of lichens that people have discovered or developed?
Yeah, this is a great question. And one place certainly where like lichen and lichen human interactions become like really apparent and really cool. And traditionally lichens were used really frequently to dye fibers. They are one of the only natural sources of the color purple. They can produce a whole array of colors like yellows and browns, reds, blues, purples, really fabulous color assortment. My favorite is the purple, actually, and that to make that dye, you have to take lichens in the rock tripe lichen group and ferment them in an ammonia solution for a while, and then you get this like beautiful color change from kind of reddish to pink and then eventually to purple. And I've had now I've had one fermenting for over a year and a half, and it's become this like royal purpley blue color. Really lovely. So lichens, great so source cool. of natural dyes. Of course, if you go for that, you know, be aware of foraging and harvesting lichens. It's not like mushrooms, where if you take a mushroom, you're not affecting most of the fungus, right? Because most of it's growing in whatever it's eating. When you take a lichen, you're killing it. So usually I recommend, if you don't know what you're collecting, just don't collect them, because there are a lot of rare and endangered lichens out there. But if you do kind of go down that rabbit hole, it's best to collect lichens that have already like fallen on the ground and things like that, so you're not actually having to harm them to make your dye baths. So dyes, and there's a history back thousands and thousands of years as people using lichens for dyes. And then their lichens are used in making perfume. So Pseudovernia furfuracea, for instance, has been used in perfumes in Europe for a very long time. And then lichens are used as a source of medicine. So whole lichen extracts are used in tinctures. Some people use the lungwort lichen tincture, Loberia pulmonaria, for any sort of respiratory infections. This is kind of a remnant of the doctrine of signatures, where if a plant looked like a body part, then we thought, aha, maybe it will treat that thing. there is that. And I know that, you know, Usnea tinctures have become quite popular. I would say, this is my kind of PSA here, that Usnea tinctures can be toxic if you take too much, and people have died from taking too much. So they can be really be a liver toxin if the concentration is too high. Now, in a more clinical setting, people have explored the use of lichens for antibiotics, for anti-cancers, as antiviral agents, and they hold huge promise for all of those applications in medicine. But one of the kind of challenges is that lichens tend to be slow growing. You can't really successfully cultivate them, both either outside as a whole lichen or in culture. They usually grow very slowly. And so actually kind of harvesting large quantities of compounds can be really challenging. But just a couple years ago now, two different groups of scientists actually figured out how to move the genes that are fundamental to making those lichen chemicals out of lichens and into fungi that grow much faster. And so it was a group of scientists from Korea and another one in California. So this is what we call heterologous expression, right? So we're moving those genes from one organism to another, and then those genes are producing their proteins, and then the proteins are putting those chemical compounds together. And so that kind of unlocks lichens as a potential, like a pharmaceutical potential in a big way that they weren't available to us before. Yeah, so it's pretty exciting. I'm really curious to see how can potential drug development goes with lichens from, you know, in the next couple of decades.
Wow. That's so cool. And it's clever to, you know, move the genes. I know that that's been done in other organisms and I'm not going to be able to think of an example, but yeah, that's definitely, I mean, that's why like in these big, you know, industrial productions of like vaccines and stuff, it's like these things are produced in organisms that they wouldn't normally produce them.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, very interesting. Is there anything about lichens that you think people misunderstand or that you'd like to clear up?
Lichens do not only grow on the north side of trees. Do not use that to direct yourself in the forest. I'm just like, I love to get all these like save yourself from like and disinformation PSAs in here. My top ones are always, it's that, be careful of the usnea tinctures. And then please don't scrape the lichens off of your trees. They really are not killing your trees. So those are my, those are my little soap boxes that I always like to squeeze in there.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I definitely want to get that information out there too. It's like we want to be able to all enjoy lichens, and we also want to make sure that we are not doing anything that would hurt us or harm us, you know, when we're using lichens. And mostly I would probably encourage people to just enjoy them where they are. So what have you learned overall from your work that's changed how you think about microbes in your daily life?
Yeah, so this one I feel like I answered before when I was talking to, and I can say it again, but when I was talking about kind of thinking about that lichen microcosm and just appreciating how much diversity there is in every lichen and how actually we are all miniature ecosystems in that same way.
I love that. I think that's a really interesting and fascinating way to view the world. And I think it's like, it just kind of, it allows us to see things in a more, it's almost whimsical if you really just like view things through that lens and you walk around and you could look at just any given thing, organism that you spot. And it's like, there's a lot more going on in and on that than it appears on the surface.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an important concept, I think, just to keep in mind and to appreciate. And it makes me stop and have like some moments of wonder, just, you know, wow, that is wild. And just, you know, the world's, it's a pretty crazy place when you stop to take a closer look at the little guys.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And I think that one of the best ways to experience those things is to actually do, you know, hands-on activities. So, and you have brought one for us. So what at-home microbiology activity can you tell us about so we can experience the microbial world in a hands-on way?
I have three lichen activity suggestions for you. Two that are a bit simpler and one that's a bit more involved. So the first one is to just convince yourself that a lichen is what I'm telling you it is. And so if you have access to a microscope and you take just a tiny piece of a lichen and put it in a small drop of water and actually like smush it under the cover slip, make like this smash mount on in water. And really less is more. You don't need very much lichen to do this. Take a look under the microscope and check that you can see that fungus, those spaghetti noodles, and those big green algal cells, those big green meatballs. So don't just take my word for it. Go look at it. That's my first one.
I love that.
And then the second one involves appreciating lichen diversity. So there, like I said, there are, you know, over 20,000 species of lichens that have been described on the planet. Well over 5,000 species live in North America alone. And it's really fun to go and just appreciate how many different lichens are around you. And you don't need to know any species names or anything like that to do this. So I would encourage you to either find a nice lichen-y tree or a nice lichen-y boulder or even just the ground somewhere and just try to find every different lichen that you possibly can and count them up. And you might be really astonished by how many species you will or like different lichens you'll see. And it's also a great way to slow down and just appreciate their different colors and their different textures. And it's especially good if you have a small hand lens, like a jeweler's loupe, and you don't need a fancy one. You know, 10x magnification is fine. You could get one for $5 and it will be more than sufficient to get an even closer look. And that's honestly, that's when the magic really happens and they really pop.
Wow.
And then the third activity is if we get a little bit more into some science, into collecting data. So if you're out there and you're wanting to actually maybe like do a little bit of graphing or data analysis, a great easy activity was developed by the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and they came up with a way to take an overhead transparency sheet, and actually finding those might be the only challenge of putting this activity together since they're not as common as they used to be. But taking an overhead transparency sheet, you can print a grid on it, and then you can set it up against trees and go out and actually measure the abundance of lichens. You could know, you know, different colors. You could break them up into different groups. And then from there, you could use what's like a miniature plot to ask a lot of questions. Maybe you're interested in looking at kind of the abundance and diversity of lichens in different parts of your hometown. You know, and generally more lichens, the better, right? Or maybe you are questioning whether I'm actually right about lichens not growing on the north side of trees, and you want to go measure that yourself and see, do they really not always grow on the north side of trees? So I think from there, you have a lot of opportunities for expanding to test many hypotheses, ask many questions, and again, Great Smoky Mountains National Park has some really fantastic resources for more of the details of how to get up and running with that activity.
Perfect. Well, thank you. Those are all really great. And we'll definitely link to the Great Smoky Mountains National Park website for that third one. And do you have any other resources that you'd recommend so listeners can go deeper on the topic?
There's a great book called Lichens of North America that is a tome of lichen knowledge and beautiful photographs. It's a very large book. So if you're really stoked mm-hmm. about lichens, that for me is like the top book on lichens. If you're still like, ooh, they're interesting, but I'm not ready to commit to this huge book, I would really just recommend trying to find a regional field guide, right? So if you're in the Northwest, the Macro Lichens of the Pacific Northwest is great. There's a really good field guide for Northeastern North America for outside of cities. And there are a few other field guides around. There's a great one for California, for instance. So just go find kind of the closest field guide that you could find. That's great. Would be a good next step. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, and then of course we'll link to your book about urban lichens. And so thank you so much. This has been really cool. And I think people will want to connect with you if it's mm-hmm. possible. So where can everyone find, follow, and you know, find you on the internet?
Yeah. So I am on Instagram, and that's about it these days. you know, sometimes I do teach courses at Highlands Biological Station in Western North Carolina. If you really want to shoot me an email, I'm happy to connect that way too.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much. This has been so fun and fascinating. And I think that people listening will probably, you know, have their view of the world, at least of lichens, changed a little bit by this. So I appreciate your time.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for the invitation. It's always always a pleasure to talk about lichens and share about lichens with new audiences.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Joyful Microbe Podcast. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. If you'd like to help others who love microbes to find the podcast, then please leave a rating and a review for the show. And tell a friend. To learn more about the Joyful Microbe, head on over to joyfulmicrobe.com, where you will find the show notes and all the links and resources mentioned. If you love Joyful Microbe and would like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a virtual tip through Ko-fi The link is in the show notes and on joyfulmicrobe.com at the bottom of the page. Thanks again, microbe friends. Talk to you next time.